Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. This morning, I'm going to start things off not with an Orson Welles shadow, because I have, over the last couple of weeks, been playing little tidbits, building up to the 80th anniversary of War of the Worlds, which will be 13 days from now, which that would be the 80th anniversary. I have a show on Halloween, but it actually aired on the 30th. I played the Orson Welles, H.G. Wells radio interview from San Antonio on KTSA on the 28th of October, 1940. I've also played Herbert Morrison's radio report of the Hindenburg disaster from the 6th of May, 1937. Because director Orson Welles wanted to capture the immediacy of the report for their Mercury Players broadcast. I guess he played that on acetones for the troop. So if you're playing acetones, you're in some pretty good company. This is from the Orson Welles sketchbook series at the BBC. Four did. The original air date was the 19th of June, 1955. He just talks about War of the Worlds like he had to for the rest of his life. This is Arthur. You're listening to the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org.
Because I was once involved in a variety of interplanetary invasion, people often ask me what I think about flying saucers. Well, truthfully, I don't have any opinion at all. I was rather impressed in reading the other day that a football match in Italy was stopped dead by one of these apparitions. The two teams ceased play and stood staring up into the sky. I think anything that can stop a football match in Italy must be a little bit stronger than an optical illusion. So I say I was rather closely involved with what purported to be an invasion from Mars. I don't know what is in those saucers, whether they're Martians or not, but we once sent some of them to America via the radio in something called the War of the Worlds. I thought you might be interested in hearing something about it. The Martians themselves look something like that. The War of the Worlds was a broadcast we did based on H.G. Wells' story of the invasion of the world by the Martians. A broadcast we did on a regular series of ours of dramatizations of famous books, some of them classics and some of them the more popular sort. We did the War of the Worlds more or less as a change of pace, and I think because we were criticized a good bit by our sound effects people for dabbling in science fiction, we made a special effort to make our show as realistic as possible. That is, we reproduced all the radio effects, not only sound effects, but, well, we did on the show exactly what would have happened if the world had been invaded. That little music playing and then an announcer coming on and saying, "Excuse me, we interrupt this program to bring you an announcement from Jersey City. Jersey City has just fallen." Take you back to our studio, a little organ music, and then another interruption, and so on. We did all of that very carefully and exactly reproduced, as I say, what would have happened, thinking to make the whole thing more effective. But we had no idea how effective it would be, because about halfway through the show, as we were continuing with the script in front of us, We saw that in the control room, there were a great many policemen, and every moment more. Now, later we found out that the police were as confused as we were because there wasn't anything they could arrest us for, but there they were, looking fierce, and a lot of people talking to other people in dumb show, and a very tense atmosphere was generated in the studio. We thought, well, something's gone wrong. Some few people have complained and have swallowed what we're telling them about the Martians having come to the world. But we didn't know that it wasn't a few people. It was, in fact, nationwide. I had no idea that I'd suddenly become a sort of national event. And it was immediately after our show went off the air that Walter Winchell, who was on a rival network and had heard about how all the telephone lines had been jammed and all the excitement was going on, went on the air on his network, on his program of news commentary, and said, "Mr. and Mrs. America, there is no cause for alarm. America has not fallen. I repeat, America has not fallen." Of course, that was really enough for that network, and by that time there wasn't a phone you could get to really anywhere in the States. The highways were jammed with cars going one way or another. Those people who were in the cities were going to the hills, and those people who were in the hills were coming into the cities. And if you think this is an exaggeration, it's only a little while ago that I again ran into some workers, some welfare workers, Quakers, and Red Cross people who had been up in the Black Hills of Dakota some 5 or 6 weeks after this broadcast, persuading the people to leave the mountains and go back home because the Martians really hadn't come. Now, since this event, during the years that have gone by since then, I've heard a number of stories about the things that happened. Some of them may seem hard to believe, but they're all verified. You'll find them in a very scholarly book which Princeton University got out on the subject of mass hysteria. And one of the stories that I like best has to do with the Navy. It's wrong to say that I like it best, because honestly, it does prey on my conscience. The United States Navy, or a great part of it, was in New York Harbor at this time. And the boys, the sailors, were all on shore leave, and they were all recalled that night for active duty. I've often felt very sorry for them, having to give up their nice holidays in order to defend America against the Martians. And I've often wondered what it was that the United States Navy ever found to tell the sailors the next morning. And there was a dinner party, very select and elegant and exclusive dinner party. And this is a really true story. I must ask you to believe that. In Long Island, the night of this broadcast, which was Halloween Eve, a lot of grand people sitting at dinner. And about halfway through dinner, the butler arrived, serving the next course, and said to the host in an undertone, which carried around the table, "I beg pardon, sir, but New Jersey has just fallen." Passed the next plate. Everyone was very contained and very polite. Nobody panicked. They waited till the next course, and the butler came around again, and the host said, Meadows, or whatever his name was, "What was that, Meadows, you said about... Why'd you hear that?" Meadows said, "On the radio, sir." The host said, "Exactly what happened?" Meadows said, "Well, I believe, sir, that the greater part of the Atlantic seaboard has capitulated." Passed another plate. Of course, everybody assumed it must be the communists or something. Third round of whatever it was, by the time the baked Alaska came, host said, "Meadows, have you ascertained who it is that's attacking us?" Meadows says, "I believe it's interplanetary, sir." And at this point, according to my informant, was highly placed and should be believed. At this point, they looked out the window, and there was a falling star. I can't vouch for that part of the story, but anyway, that's what's told. Anyway, all kinds of people reacted in all kinds of ways. For example, John Barrymore, the very famous American actor, this I know to be true, was listening to the broadcast, and although he was a friend of mine, ceased to identify me with the show and believed implicitly that America had fallen to the Martians. And hearing this on his radio, rushed out into his backyard where he kept 10 Great Danes in a kennels and released the dogs, giving them their freedom, crying to them as they ran in all directions of a compass, "The world has fallen, fend for yourselves." And I still meet people all over the place, everywhere in the world, who've had experiences, bitter or otherwise, as a result of our little experiment in broadcasting. Just the other day, I was coming here to England on the ferry, and some people were in the next compartment on the boat. The boat train said to me, "There you are, Orson. Well, you sure scared us. We were on our honeymoon, my wife and I." Sorry to say that they looked very ancient couple, but there they were. I said, "We were on our honeymoon and had a little portable radio. We were out there by the lake and heard what you said. We come right back home. That spoiled the honeymoon, but glad to see yours." And that kind of thing has followed me all over the world since then. I'll never forget, as long as I live, I'll never forget the first awful moments after the broadcast when, as I say, the police were ringing us around and the atmosphere was unbearably tense. And such vice presidents as were left on the network motioned me quickly to the telephones, which were just off the air, and said, you must answer some of the phones. And I picked up one. I remember the first voice, which said, "Hello." I said, "Hello." One is used, you know, after broadcast, to talking to people. Sometimes they want to tell you they didn't like the show. Sometimes they say they did and want to thank you. And I want to say, "Thank you very much, Mr. Smith, for enjoying." He says, "Hello." I said, "Hello." He said,
"My wife is... he's out in the church, and all my children are out there praying. I was..."
I said, "What? Beg your pardon, sir?" He said, "Is your name H.G. Wells?" And I said, no, this is Orson Wells." He says, "I don't care which relative you are, will you get my wife and children away from the church because they're praying?" I said, "Well, it must be very nice to be... have them so religious, sir." And he said, "Well, isn't the question of being religious? I want somebody back in my own. What are we going to do?" And a lot of people wanted to know what to do. As a matter of fact, they were phoning us from all over the place, some of them reporting that they'd seen Martians landing in their backyards and asking for advice. And there were others that claimed to have been attacked personally by Martians. And the whole experience was extremely intense. And it was 4 or 5 years later, when I was on the air doing a show, very polite show with a lot of people, choruses, singing, and so on. Well, that's a typical solemn Sunday broadcast on commercial sound radio in America at the time, with full choir and orchestra and everything else. And for some reason, at this time, this particular Sunday that I've illustrated, we were doing a patriotic broadcast with excerpts from Walt Whitman and I don't know what else, Norman Cohen, all the rest of it. Choirs humming melodically and so on, and I was in the midst of some hymn of praise to the American cornfields or something of the kind when suddenly a gentleman darted into the radio studio, held up his hand and said, "We interrupt this broadcast to bring you an announcement. Pearl Harbor has just been attacked." Of course, this very serious and terrible news was never believed, not for hours, by anybody in America, because they all said, "Well, there he goes again," really. Rather bad taste. Was funny once, but not a second time. I suppose we had it coming to us because, in fact, we weren't as innocent as we meant to be when we did the Martian broadcast. We were fed up with the way in which everything that came over this new magic box, the radio, was being swallowed. People, you know, do suspect what they read in the newspapers and what people tell them, but when the radio came, and I suppose now television, anything that came through that new machine was believed. So in a way, our broadcast was an assault on the credibility of that machine. We wanted people to understand that they shouldn't take any opinion predigested, and they shouldn't swallow everything that came through the tap, whether it was radio or not. But as I say, it was only a partial experiment. We had no idea the extent of the thing, and I certainly personally had no idea what it would mean to me. As in fact, my life, I'm now going back to the time of the actual broadcast, my life was threatened. There was somebody, as a matter of fact, who kept telephoning about every quarter of an hour saying, "You will die on the opening night of your play." As a matter of fact, the opening night of my play was the night after the broadcast. It was a play called Danton's Death that we did in my theater, and which incidentally was a horrible flop. And at the end of the play, I had to stand in front of the curtain and deliver a speech in the character of Saint-Just on the subject of something, I think it was the French Revolution. Anyway, I had to be alone in front of the curtain in a blazing white spotlight. And I promise you that I've never been so terrified in my life. I had to come out in front of this audience waiting for the sound of a pistol being cocked, some angry victim of our broadcast shooting at me, deliver this speech. But what actually happened was that as I stood in front of the curtain, there was a little spill from the spotlight. I could see the front row in the audience. There was a man sitting in the front row who looked up at me. I say the play was a flop. People didn't like it. They're probably right. Man who looked up at me as I opened my mouth to speak, raised his hand, looked at his wristwatch, looked at me, went, folded his arms. Well, I assure you that I would rather have been shot. At least that's the way I felt about it.
That was from BBC Four, Orson Welles discussing reaction and antidotes to the War of the Worlds. It's a five-part Orson Welles quote-unquote sketchbook where he literally sketches pictures in this particular broadcast of him wearing an outer space suit. And just some of it's interesting. I just extracted episode 5, which was titled War of the Worlds, for this particular show because I'm featuring certain tidbits leading up to the 80th anniversary of War of the Worlds. Next up on the docket, this is regular listeners. We'll be happy to hear this. Go ahead and cue it up on the Spinatron. Again, regular listeners, I've been waiting for this for a while. This is Arthur. You're listening to The Grand Hour here on WMFO Medford.
You'll hear James Stewart as the Six Shooter, just one of the many fine programs brought to you Sundays on NBC. Later this evening, listen to the NBC Star Playhouse with one of your favorite stars. Hear Meet the Press, America's number one newsmaking program, and be sure to keep tuned for the dramatic story of communism in America on Last Man Out. It's a wonderful lineup of great programs, all of them heard only on NBC. James Stewart as the Six Shooter. The man in the saddle is angular and long-legged. His skin is sun-dyed brown. The gun in his holster is gray steel and rainbow mother of pearl. Its handle unmarked. People call them both the Six Shooter. B-52 The NBC Radio Network presents James Stewart as the Six Shooter, a transcribed series of radio dramas based on the life of Britt Ponsett, the Texas plainsman who wandered through the Western territories, leaving behind a trail of still-remembered legends.
I sure don't know where the town ever got that name. Quiet City. Every time I came through it, it was anything but quiet. In the old days, the Apaches were always stirring up trouble. After the Indians were moved onto the reservation, there was still plenty of excitement. Oh, there was shooting practically every weekend. At least that's how it was when I was here last. Of course, that was, about 4 or 5 years ago, I guess. And now the town did seem sort of different at first glance. Anyhow, there were 20 or 30 new houses along the side of the creek there. The main street was a good 4 blocks longer than what I remember. Quiet City sure was growing up. There couldn't be any doubt about that. I figured the population must have reached the 1,000 mark, maybe even higher. And all that growing made the place seem, kind of settled and businesslike. To tell you the truth, Quiet City was almost quiet. Anyhow, I headed Scar over to the hitching rail in front of the sheriff's office and pulled up. Whoa, boy. Whoa, Scar. Whoa. The door of the office was open.
Something I can do for you? Britt!
Hello, Hank. How are you?
Britt, you old son of a gun. Why didn't you let a body know you were heading this way?
Well, I didn't know it myself till last week. Tim Parker came into some property over by Fulton. He asked me to sit on it for a couple of months till he could take charge.
Oh, Fulton, huh?
Yeah, it's real nice.
Farming land.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim wasn't certain.
That's all there is over that way now. There ain't no more ranches, Britt, just farms.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, I guess this part of the country's changing.
Yeah, some, I reckon.
Mm-hmm. I sure wouldn't have recognized Quiet City, Hank. It's not a small town anymore, is it?
No, we've done our share of growing. There ain't no doubt about that.
Well, more than your share, I'd say.
But the people are the same, Britt. Oh, maybe they buy more ready-made clothes than they used to and send most of their kids to school, but that's just a skin change. Underneath, they ain't no different.
Still giving you trouble, huh?
I've got them under a tight rein most of the time. But if I was to turn them loose, we'd be right back to where we was 20 years ago.
Oh, I don't know about
well,
that.
Well, I do. Mm-hmm. Well, what I mean is, Britt, you can't expect human nature to start improving overnight, you know.
Oh, that's true enough, yeah.
But some folks don't see it my way. They think that just because we've got churches and a schoolhouse and a railroad depot, we're like them towns back east, peaceful and half asleep. Where all you need a sheriff for is to lock up the Saturday night drunks. Why, back there, they don't even call them sheriffs. They call them peace officers. Well, I ain't no peace officer. I'm a sheriff. And this is still the West.
Sure.
Just drop my guard once. That's all I'd need to do. They'd be killing each other right out there in the main street.
Yeah, well, I guess you'd be the best judge of that. How's Buzz? How's he?
Oh, about the same.
Full grown, I'll bet. How old is he now?
20, last birthday.
No.
Yeah, he's a big fella, too. 6'3".
Oh, well, taller than you are, huh?
An inch or so.
You made him a deputy yet?
What are you talking about?
Well, you always said that when the time came, you were going to fix it so Buzz could just slide right into your boots. Don't you remember that?
Yeah, I remember. But sometimes things don't work out the way a man plans.
Uh-huh.
You know, Buzz has got ideas of his own. Crazy fool ideas. I offered him a job working with me, but he wouldn't have none of it. He's aiming to leave Quiet City.
Oh, is that so?
And you know why, Britt? So's he can go to school.
Uh-huh, I say.
It ain't as if I didn't see to it that he got his learning. I promised his ma before she died. Promised her I'd see that he was brung up right. And I kept my word, too. I sent him the very first day Jane Weatherby started teaching. And I didn't take him out when he'd learned to just read and write and figure. No, I let him keep on till he got his diploma. I guess that's where I was wrong. I should have took him out before he got too smart for his own good.
Oh, now, heck, now. The more education a man gets, the better he's off.
I ain't so sure of that. Life ain't in books. How much schooling did you have?
Well, a little more wouldn't have done me any harm.
You've made out all right, and so have I. So would Buzz if he'd come to his senses and stay here where he belongs.
When's he leaving?
He was getting his things together when I left the house this morning. Maybe he's gone by now for all I know.
Oh, no, he wouldn't do that, not without saying goodbye to you.
Britt.
Yeah?
I was just thinking. If Buzz still is here, if he hasn't left yet, maybe you could talk.
Oh, now, hold on.
He won't listen to me, Britt.
No.
But if you was to...
Hello, Pa.
What do you want, Buzz?
I'd like to speak to you if you're not too busy, that is.
For a minute, Heck didn't answer. He just stared at the leather satchel in his son's hand. Buzz was a big fellow, all right. Husky, plenty of muscles. But somehow his face didn't match his body, especially his eyes. They were kind of tired-looking. And he kept blinking as though he wasn't used to the daylight. And there were wrinkles in his forehead, too. Not the kind you get from riding against the sun. Just little creases that made him look older than he really was.
Well, Buzz, with all your fancy education, ain't you got manners enough to speak to Britt Ponsett?
Oh, I'm sorry I didn't recognize you. It's been quite a spell.
Well, I can't say I blame you, Buzz. I wouldn't have known you in a month of Sundays. Well, if you'll excuse me,
No, there's no reason for you to go, Britt. I just wanted to tell Pa goodbye. I'm taking the 4 o'clock train east, Pa.
I see.
Well, I'll be back someday.
That's mighty considerate of you.
Well, so long.
Just you hold up a minute, young fella. You won't pay no attention to me, I know that. Well, Britt here ain't got no axe to grind. If he says you're loco, if he says you're going off on a wild goose chase, maybe then you'll...
Now, Heck, this isn't any of my concern, and even if it was...
You ain't heard it all, Britt. You don't know what he aims to do with his extra schooling. A lawyer. That's what he wants to be.
Oh?
That's what I'm going to be, Pa.
Tell him the rest of it, Buzz. Tell him how you're going to come back here and practice law. Ain't that rich, Britt? Quiet City is going to have a full-fledged lawyer.
Look, Pa, do we have to go all over that again?
Why, you'll be the laughingstock. This town ain't got no use for a lawyer. Never will have. A sheriff. That's what the town will need. A new sheriff. I ain't getting any younger, Britt. First thing you know, I'll be 60. A 60-year-old sheriff won't be able to hold folks in check. Not for long.
Yeah, sure, they'll need a new sheriff, and I'm sorry that I'm just not the man for the job.
You could be that man if you wanted
yes,
to.
Yes, but I don't want to, Pa. I want to be a lawyer, and I'll be more used to the town that way.
Ah.
Oh, look, you've got to understand, these are different times.
What's so different about them?
Everything. You think we're still living on the frontier. You think that star in your vest and that six-gun in your holster is still the only law around here. Well, you're wrong, Pa. You're dead wrong. This isn't the frontier anymore. You're not the law. You're just supposed to carry it out.
Ain't that what I've been doing all these years?
Ah, look, I'm not saying that your way isn't what the town needed once, but your job is done. You can't expect me to take up where you left off. I'm not you, Pa. This isn't the same town it was. These people aren't the same ones who settled here 20 years ago.
Britt, you see what I mean, Britt?
Well, maybe he's right, Heck.
You think everything's changed, too?
Well, some things, anyway.
What about folks themselves, deep down inside? They're still the same. Some of them are decent and law-abiding, and others as mean as the devil and always will be.
You just won't believe the town's civilized now, will you?
You'll see how civilized it is when the chips are down. You'll see, Mr. Lawyer.
Well, looks like we just don't agree, Pa, and we never will, so... It's nice seeing you again, Britt.
Yeah, good seeing you, Buzz.
So long, Pa. Good luck.
Hey, Buzz, you're on there, man.
Yeah, I hear Doc.
I'm telling you to get out to James Martin's place. There's been a shooting. Pipe Clampers on it. Folks say that James is hurt bad. Now tell your Pa to get right out there.
Okay, Doc, I'll tell him.
There you are. That's how much Quiet City has changed, Buzz. Folks still shooting each other, still taking the law in their own hands. Sure are civilized, ain't they?
I'll go with you, Pa.
What for? So as you can advise Pipe Clamper of his lawful rights when I arrest him? Get out of my way, Buzz. I've got work to do.
Ain't been a shooting, Britt, for over 2 years, huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, I reckon there's been one today.
Yeah. Looks like Pa was right. All my talk about this town growing up, it's just what it was, talk.
Maybe so.
Well, I better get over to Jace Norton's and see if Pa needs help. He's not as young as he used to be if he tries to take Pipe Clamper alone.
Well, do you think he'd let you help him, even if he needed it?
No, I guess he wouldn't. But somebody... But?
No, he wouldn't appreciate me interfering in his business either.
Well, now, if you just happen to be riding out east of town, sort of stopped off...
East, huh?
Yeah. The Norton Ranch is right next to old Miss Bradley's place.
Oh, is that so?
Mm-hmm.
That's so. Oh. Well, that's quite a coincidence.
Oh?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was figuring on dropping in on Maddie Bradley before I left town. Maybe have supper with her if she invited me.
Mm-hmm. It's getting on toward supper now.
Oh, you don't say. Time sure does fly, doesn't it? I had no idea that late.
We'll return to James Stewart as the Six Shooter in just a moment. But right now, I want you to hear something that may startle you. At least, I hope it will. It's simply this. Within the next 20 seconds, a fire will break out somewhere in the United States. Lives may be lost, property damaged, homes or buildings destroyed. Yes, there are 4,600 fires in America each day of the year. They kill 11,000 persons and disfigure or severely burn thousands more. By obeying a few simple rules of fire prevention from now on, you and I can protect ourselves and our families from this devastating menace. Rule one is an obvious one. Don't smoke in bed or discard lighted cigarettes carelessly. Rule two, clean out old newspapers, magazines, and other inflammable debris. Rule three, use only those cleaning fluids which will not burn. And last but not least, be careful with matches. Above all, keep them out of the reach of small children. Remember, it doesn't pay to gamble with fire. The odds are against you every time. Now, Act Two of The Six Shooter, starring James Stewart as Britt Ponsett.
I was standing on the front porch of Jace Norton's house when I rode in the yard. And there was a woman sitting on a rocking chair talking to him. Her face was dead white, just like all the blood had been drained out of her cheeks. For a minute or so, Heck just stood there nodding. Then he shifted his weight and noticed me out of the corner of one eye.
Come on up, Britt.
Easy, boy. Easy. I was just on my... way over to Miss Bradley's, I thought...
This is Britt Ponsett, Mrs. Norton.
Ponsett.
I'm pleased to meet you, ma'am. I sure hope your husband
is... Jace is dead.
Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am.
Pipe Clamper murdered him. I seen him do it. I seen it all through the kitchen window.
I'm sorry.
How did it start, Mabel?
They's arguing about some cows that had strayed onto our land. Pipe said Jace was trying to steal them, that he'd fixed her fences so they'd come through. But it wasn't true, Sheriff. It wasn't true.
Sure.
Jace was aiming to take the cows back. He told me at breakfast this morning, I've got to run some of Pipe's cattle back to him. That's what Jace said at breakfast this morning. Hadn't had time to do it yet. Been busy with chores and things. Mare was foaling. Jace hadn't had time, but he was going to take him back. He told me so.
No. Don't get yourself all upset, Mabel.
I heard him quarreling out and back, Pipe and Jace. I didn't think nothing of it. Pipe's always quarreling with everybody. You know that.
Yeah, I know.
And the next thing I knew, I heard a shot. I thought Pipe was just trying to scare Jace. Until I saw Jace fall down.
Pipe right off toward his own place?
No. Toward the canyon. Over that way. I remember asking myself why is Pipe heading toward the canyon. His ranch is the other way. It just hadn't dawned on me yet. What he'd done, that he was running away.
Yes. Well, it's turning chilly. You better go inside now, Mabel.
Yeah? Yeah,
Doc Anderson is sending somebody out to fix supper and stay with you tonight.
You'll find Pipe, Sheriff. You'll find him. Bring him back.
Sure, I'll find him. You want me to help you up?
I can manage.
Yeah, here we are. That's there.
I'm pleased to have met you, Mr. Ponsett.
Thank you, ma'am.
I've heard of you, haven't I?
He's the six shooter, Mabel.
Six shooter?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, of course, that's why. I'm glad you're here, Mr. Ponsett. I'm glad you're going with the sheriff. I wouldn't want Pipe to kill somebody else. Even if he wasn't punished for what he did to Jason. I wouldn't want there to be another killing. I'm glad you're going with the sheriff.
Well, looks like I've got me a deputy after all.
Now, Buzz was willing to come, Hack. He wanted to.
I'd rather have you, Britt. Let's go.
Well, we picked up Pipe Clamper's trail about sundown. At least it was the only fresh trail heading toward the canyon, so we figured Pipe had made it. The next couple of hours was pretty dark, so we had to move slow, keeping our eyes glued to the ground. Then along about 8 o'clock, the moon came out, and we could make better time. We were in the canyon now. The way the hoof marks were spaced, we could tell that Pipe's horse was getting tired, and Pipe had to be forced to ride a little easier.
Looks like we might be gaining on him, Britt.
Yeah. Any place around here he could hole up?
An old trading post about a mile ahead. Been deserted since the Indians moved south. He could be there.
Uh-huh.
Britt.
Yeah?
Maybe you think it's funny I wanted you to go along with me tonight, but... Well, it's not that I couldn't bring Pipe Clamper in alone, but there's more to it than that. It's when we get back to town, that's when I'll need you.
Oh?
Yeah, you see, Jason Norton was a well-liked man. He lived in Quiet City, practically from the very beginning. Everybody knew him. Everybody liked him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But nobody has any use for Pipe Clamper. Like I told you, some fellas are just mean. Pipe's one of them. Anyway, what I'm getting at is this. Jace has a brother, Abe Norton. And he'll be fighting mad when he finds out what happened today. He'll be killing mad. And the whole town will go along with him.
Mm-hmm. You mean they might try and lynch Pipe? Huh?
They'll try.
Uh-huh. Well, you can't be certain of that, Hank.
I know the town, Britt. There hasn't been any trouble for 2 years. That's a long time. A lot of pressure builds up in 2 years. Now, Jace's murder, that'll set folks off. I hope you'll be willing to give me a hand.
Well, you know I'll do what I can, Hack.
It's him, Britt. He's up there behind the tree.
Well, the bullet smashed into Hack's leg and tore him right out of the saddle. I dived off Scar and took cover behind a rock. There was a clump of trees hanging to the side of the canyon about 100 yards ahead. I could make out something that looked like a building with a carved totem pole out in front of it. I figured that was the trading post Heck had been telling us about. But the shots weren't coming from inside. Whoever was firing was using the Indian post for a shield. You all right, Heck?
It's just my leg, Britt. Afraid I can't move it, though.
Well, I'll get over to you.
No. You stay where you are. I'm out of his range. There's a tree between me and him. But it looks like you'll have to take him, Britt. I said I wouldn't need you till we got back to town, but it looks like...
It sounded like Heck had passed out. I raised my head up to the edge of the boulder. When I couldn't see Heck, there was a great big fir tree right in front of him. Well, that meant Pipe Clamper couldn't see him either. He sure could see me, though. That moonlight was just pouring down on that rock where I was hiding, and if I so much as moved, I was right in plain sight. I waited a couple minutes. I hadn't done any firing yet. Maybe he'd think I was hit. Maybe he'd come over after me. Yeah, that was my best chance. I listened hard. I couldn't hear anything. He was still behind that totem pole, still playing it safe. As long as the moon kept me pinpointed,
I looked up in the sky just in time to see a great big cloud float toward the orange circle over my head. A big white cloud, big enough to give me a minute of dark. It was still moving, sweeping across the stars now, and then it hit the edge of the moon. I swung out from behind the rock, and I headed toward the trees between me and the trading post. Pipe heard me all right. Not in time, though. Not until I was up beside one of the trees, about 30 yards from where he was waiting. And the sky was beginning to whiten up now, and I saw Pipe's arm inching around the edge of the totem pole. I knew a slug in his arm wasn't going to be enough. I pushed up on my haunches, and I ran forward. He raised his gun, ready to get off another shot. I twisted one side and let fire. His shot was close, but he missed me. Well, I hadn't done much better. I crawled along, keeping myself as flat as I could, moving real slow. Not more than a foot every 2 or 3 minutes, and straining my ears, trying to hear him breathe. He was only about 10 feet away now. And there weren't any more trees between us, just open space. I pressed my belly down into the dirt. My gun just poking up just an inch or so. Just enough so that... And then I saw his gun. A little beam of moonlight bounced off the barrel. And I saw the shadow of his head easing across the ground beside that totem pole. Drop it, Pipe.
What?
Now get on your feet. He stood up, and his face came into the moonlight, and he took a step forward, and then his left hand jerked out toward me. My bullet hit his shoulder and spun him around, and he crashed into the totem pole. And for a second, I thought it was going to topple over with him, but it held firm. Good morning, Hack.
Morning.
It's almost noon, as a matter of fact. Doc Anderson said you ought to be coming too by now.
My leg.
No, it's going to be all right. It'll be all right. Doc says for you just not to fuss about it. It'll be all right.
Thanks for bringing me home, Britt. I don't know how you manage, but...
Hello, Pa. How you feeling?
Fine, Buzz. Just first rate. I see you didn't leave town.
Nope, didn't leave.
Well, I guess maybe what Pipe done wasn't all of the bad. Not if it brung you to your senses. Something, anyhow. You killed him, huh, Britt?
No. He's kind of worse for wear, but he'll be patched up in time for a trial.
Well, where is he?
The doc's looking after him.
You mean he ain't in jail? You mean nobody's guarding but Doc Anderson?
Well, we weren't very worried about him running off.
That ain't what I'm talking about. Britt, I told you what had happened. I told you what Jace Norton's brother would do.
Oh, that. Well, you see, heck, Abe Norton's already been around. He's gone back to his ranch now.
Gone back?
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, folks just wouldn't pay any attention to him. Sure, they all feel real bad about Jace, like you said they would, and they all think that Pipe deserves a hanging, but... They're pretty convinced that's what the judge will give him.
The judge? But that don't make sense.
Well, that's the truth, Carl. Everybody's satisfied that there'll be a fair trial and that Pipe will get what's coming to him.
Why, in the old days, they wouldn't have stood still for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess these aren't the old days.
Then Buzz was right. That talk about Quiet City being civilized?
Don't fret yourself about it now, Pa.
It just don't seem possible. This ain't the same town. These folks ain't the same. Well, what happened to them, Britt?
Oh, I don't know. I guess maybe a town grows up just like a person, Hank. And I guess maybe you had something to do with it, too.
Me?
Mm-hmm. You see, somebody taught him to respect the law and to try to live up to it. And if it wasn't you, I sure don't know who it was.
Well, Buzz stayed around Quiet City until Heck was on his feet again. And then Heck himself sent the boy east to college. That was, oh, let's see, 3-4 years ago again. The last time I was through that way, Buzz had come home. You see, Buzz was running for county attorney. Yes, sir. And the way Heck was managing his campaign, well, if that election didn't turn out to be a landslide, I sure missed my guess.
Until recent years, misconceptions prompted many to feel that a diagnosis of heart disease was a death sentence. But today, thanks to medical science and the educational work of your Heart Association, we are learning that most people with heart disease can work and lead happy lives. But the real answer to heart disease lies in heart research and community heart programs, which can be expanded through your continued support of the Heart Fund. This is not only Valentine's Day, but it's Heart Sunday. So make it a point to give to your local Heart Association now. And remember, when you help your Heart Fund, you help your heart. The Six Shooter is a transcribed NBC Radio Network production in association with Review Productions. It is based on a character created by Frank Burt and is written by him. Mr. Stewart may currently be seen in the Universal International picture The Glenn Miller Story. Others in the cast were Virginia Gregg, Robert Griffin, Lamont Johnson, and Will Wright. Special music for this program was by Basil Adlam, and the entire production is under the direction of Jack Johnstone. All characters and incidents were fictitious, and any resemblance to actual characters or incidents is purely coincidental. Oh, by the way, you'll be interested in knowing that the Six Shooter has been chosen for broadcast to our men overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Services. This is John Wall speaking. Listen to Jan Murray in Sunday at Home on the NBC Radio Network.
This is a firearm safety PSA. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. Rule 0. All guns are always loaded. Rule 1. Never point a gun at anything you are not willing to destroy. Rule 2. Keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you have made the decision to shoot. Rule 3. Be sure of your target and what is beyond it. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Gun safety. WMFO, Medford.
Okay, that was Episode 23, The Six Shooter, titled The Quiet City. The original air date was the 14th of February, 1954. I know some of y'all that have been listening for a while are glad to hear that. I'm glad to play it, because there's about 40 episodes, so I got about 37 left to go. And coming up next, this is interesting. This is from the AT&T archive. Operators help save the world from Martians. It was part of a series called Directions and part of an internal AT&T video news magazine. The series started in 1985. So we'll see about this. I was to understand that some of the CD players weren't working here, so I'm playing off the laptop this morning. Only to see that all the CD players are operational. This is Arthur, listening to Grand Hour, 91.5 FM, and or WMFO.org.
Before we had 911, we had the switchboard operator. telephone subscribers came to rely on the ever-present, reassuring voices that greeted them when they picked up their phone or dialed zero. When a fire broke out, or a child went missing, or a loved one became sick or injured, the operator was called to summon help. And it was not unusual to hear stories of great personal courage demonstrated by operators who would remain at the switchboards to warn others of impending danger rather than flee ahead of a threatening storm. So it should come as no surprise that on that Halloween Eve in 1938, when Martians were believed to have landed in New Jersey and a full-on invasion of Earth appeared to be underway, operators remained at their posts and did their best to calm the legions of distressed callers who reached out to them in genuine fear for their very lives. The story you are about to hear is real. Straight from the AT&T Archives and History Center, here's War of the Worlds, Operator versus the Martians.
The ever-popular Stardust, Raymond Riccolo and his orchestra.
Back in those days, to get to the telephone company was, if you didn't go to college, you went to the telephone company. It was very well thought of and prestigious type of job.
Because that was the thing to be. My mother was a telephone operator, my aunt was a telephone operator, and I can't ever remember wanting to be anything but.
We interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin.
Racing isn't the only thing on my mind. And with GoDaddy, I'm making my ideas real.
From the Intercontinental Radio News.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars.
Every light on that board lit. Now that board was, I would say, almost a half block long.
Our board lit up when they announced that the Martians were coming across the George Washington Bridge. And that's when the excitement started.
Some people said, did I have a chance to see them? What were they like? What did they look like?
I figured them little peoples. I don't mean foot tall. Little peoples, green in color with a flowing hood.
Have you seen any Martians?
No. They're going over to New York. Tonight the sky's alive with their lights, just as if people were still living.
Because they were crying and screaming and wanting to know if there was a lot of gas, if there was a lot of destruction. Were there fires? Is there a lot of shooting? Are there bodies all around?
But people believed it. They really believed it that night. And I think of the ones who were begging us to get connections to their families, to their husbands, to mothers and fathers before the world came to an end so they could just tell them they loved them.
At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill.
One man told me that people were jumping out of the windows and they were going to kill their families before the Martians could get them.
You see, it was not a case of answering a light and connecting them to somebody else. All they wanted was the operator.
I was just so concerned that I was going to be able to help all these people. And never a thought of getting out of there because my life was in danger. Because I believe part of it was with the old telephone company training, you are very dedicated to your job. You stay there through thick or thin.
A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country.
And one lady, probably minutes or many minutes after the onset, said they're as far as Chicago now. And I thought, if they're traveling that fast, they're going to be in Missoula before I get off duty.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be.
Any man that could cause that kind of upheaval in a whole country from coast to coast has got to be great.
We were exhausted when it was over with, but I look back now, I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
This has been the December 88 edition of DSG Directions. In each edition, you'll hear Bob Peck.
Okay, sorry about that. In case you didn't realize that, I was playing off of a YouTube channel. Sorry, because I don't have a flash drive or something on my computer to extract that exactly from the archive. But that was AT&T operators recalling their night that they worked the switchboard. Thanks for listening. Marco's up next. I'm going to play out with a little... I wanted to play some Bernard Herrmann, but God forbid the studio doesn't have any. Because he actually did the soundtrack for Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds. Till next week, this is Arthur. Have a nice day.